Welcome to the second part of Division 3 of the Court of Appeals. We have one case on the reconstituted panel and the docket. That's Hadley versus Countrywide Home Loans. That is case number 2009 CV3383. To my right is Judge Boris. To my left is Judge Ney, senior judge who's kind enough to sit in today for Judge Roy, and I'm Judge Roman. If you have any pagers or anything that might go off, please turn them off at this time. And then otherwise, I think we are ready to proceed. So, counsel.
Making sure it's on.
May it please the court, counsel. Good afternoon, your honors. My name is R. William Rowe, attorney, Colorado attorney registration number 28813, here on behalf of the appellants Ray Ann and Stephen Hadley. What we have before your honors is a relatively, concrete issue, which was the dismissal of the Hadley's complaint based on certain actions undertaken by Countrywide. The trial court dismissed the Hadley's complaint based on the Colorado statute of frauds relating to credit agreements. The issue that we have and we believe is inappropriate in this case is that that extended the concept of the statute of frauds related to credit agreements beyond the credit agreements or things that related to the credit agreements themselves. The trial judge took a position that anything related to credit agreements was therefore barred by the statute of frauds. In this particular case, the Hadleys had engaged with, discussed, and received specific confirmation from Countrywide that it had engaged in wrongdoing, that it had messed up the situation, if you will. And they entered into an agreement with Countrywide about how they were going to handle that. They entered into agreement to deal with the credit reporting. They entered into an agreement to deal with a separate provision called Countrywide Soft Landing Program. Countrywide did, in fact, provide writings confirming this. Countrywide sent them confirmations that they had done something under the credit agreement. Under the credit repair agreement that they had entered into with Countrywide. They did send some confirmation they had undertaken certain actions. But unfortunately, they didn't do all they were supposed to do, but that was dismissed out of hand under the rubric of a credit agreement with Countrywide. The trial court determined that it related to the deeds of trust, the mortgages that the Hadleys had with Countrywide. And therefore, since there was some
didn't the court basically find that these were modifications to the previous agreement, modifications as to time of payment and so forth, and that those modifications were not in writing, signed by, in this case, the lender?
Your Honor, I think the trial court took two approaches on that, honestly. I think with regard to the Hadley's original discussion with Countrywide about forbearing, about dealing with putting their payments on the back end, about doing that, I do believe that's what the court decided. I believe that the court
right,
didn't...
Now, can I stop you right there? Now, didn't what you just said, weren't those modifications to the original agreement, which were not in writing, signed by the lender?
Well, Your Honor, that does not encompass all of the agreements, so I can't say yes or
okay.
no to that.
All right.
So I understand what you're saying. I believe that there's two separate sets of issues here. I believe that the trial court did say that with regard to the discussions of loan forbearance. I believe that the court said something different when it addressed the issue of the credit repair agreement, when it addressed those other ancillary things. I don't believe it said their credit agreements are not in writing. I believe what the trial court said is they relate to a credit agreement, therefore there's not a separate writing, therefore they're dismissed.
Relate to is a fairly broad term. So how do you draw the line as to when something relates to or doesn't relate to?
Well, Your Honor, I agree. And that's something that, frankly, I have struggled with in this particular situation. I've read thousands of pages of the law on this particular issue. And where I come down is not necessarily where you will come down, to be honest.
I'd like to hear where you come down.
But where I come down is, if it relates to repayment, forbearance, dealing with the fundamental terms of your credit agreement, it's got to somehow be included there. If it relates to a separate agreement that isn't going to change the terms of your mortgage, that isn't going to change your lender's ability to collect, that isn't trying to manufacture an agreement to lend or repay money where there is no writing, then I believe that you go too far if you say any relationship that where there's a creditor and a borrower, any relationship, any separate agreement, or any accommodation you reach that doesn't reach those fundamental terms of your mortgage in this particular case, then I think you go too far to say, well, then the bank is immune because they didn't send you a specific writing on that.
So let's put the credit repair agreement aside for a moment, but the agreement to basically stop payments and put those on the end, doesn't that really, though, change the terms as far as when, how quickly the money is paid back and what dates?
I think that it does potentially change the underlying terms of when, but I don't think that it really changed the terms of the obligation that they had with them. They didn't say that it changed the amount that was owed. They didn't say that it changed the amount that was due. They didn't say that it was going to change their fundamental obligations. They just relied on what Countrywide said. And I agree, it's a conundrum here without the writing. But then I also come back to, where do you draw the line? If at any point that Countrywide can do anything it wants and to any borrower and then say, we didn't send you a writing, especially at a motion to dismiss stage, when we're pretty sure, given the stuff that came in the mail, that there do exist writings, but we weren't able to even conduct any discovery on that particular issue.
Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Given how broad the statute is and given its intent, why do you have to draw the line?
Well, Your Honor, I believe the statute intent was to discourage lender liability suits. And I do believe that it was designed to protect lenders from situations of he said, she said. I think our Supreme Court has made that clear. But I don't think it reaches a situation where you just give a pass to any bank to be able to do anything it wants to its borrowers. So I think you do have to draw a line, because I don't think it was written as an absolute immunity statute. And I don't think it was written to cover the entire universe of any discussion or any agreement that came into place between a borrower and a bank. Short answer, but that's the honest to God viewpoint that I have. And if it has been extended to that point where it's an absolute immunity statute, then I submit it shouldn't be interpreted that way. I submit that absolutely, you have to rely on the writings. You have to rely on those things for the credit agreements. I don't think you can similarly give a pass to a bank and its lenders when they, its borrowers, when they engage in separate sort of agreements. And Your Honor, I don't think we can necessarily set aside the credit repair agreement, because that was a separate issue and relates to, if we interpret that so broadly, so be it. But I would submit to Your Honors that that is not the case that it should be. And I don't believe the legislature spoke to give an absolute pass to every bank by their ability to just say, we didn't write it down in writing, so it doesn't matter under whatever universe we have. If you're talking about the mortgage, absolutely it comes down to that. If you're talking about something else, I don't think it covers that. I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, Your Honors. I know you've read the briefs. If you don't have any further questions.
May it please the court. My name is Eric Coakley, attorney number 34238, and I'm appearing today on behalf of Appellee Countrywide. Now, the statute of frauds for credit agreements simply codifies practical advice that if you want to be certain, get it in writing. To put the statute in historical context, statute of frauds have been enacted to prevent fraud by perjury. And the very first statute of fraud goes back to 1677, when Parliament passed the Act for Prevention of Fraud and Perjuries. Because after oral promises became enforceable through the writ of assumpsit, courts were besieged by what they perceived to be people committing perjury in order to have the courts enforce agreements that didn't exist. And so since that time, legislatures have enacted statute of frauds to avoid oral agreements for contract and land, for agreements that are not to be performed in 1 year, and promises to answer for the debts of other. Now, in 1989, the state of Colorado found itself in a financial downturn, not dissimilar from the financial downturn of today, where there are a large number of foreclosures, and courts found they were being besieged by borrowers who were claiming that lenders had orally modified the terms of their agreements to forbear, that they wouldn't foreclose pending certain conditions. Now, the Mortgage Bankers Association lobbied the legislature, and the legislature agreed, and it passed the statute of fraud for credit agreements to discourage lender litigation and to promote certainty in credit agreements involving sums of more than $25,000. Your Honor asked, where do you draw the line? Well, the statute of frauds for credit agreements is very clear. You draw the line on any agreement relating to a credit agreement if it's in writing and signed by the lender.
Absolute immunity?
Excuse me?
Your counterpart used the phrase that there's absolute immunity if we were to agree with your position.
Your Honor, I think that's a straw man argument. The statute of the frauds for credit agreements simply says get it in writing. There's not absolute immunity. There are plenty of other requirements that particularly a mortgage loan has to comply with in terms of disclosures to borrower. There's liability under the Federal Truth in Lending Act. There's liability under RESPA. There's even liability for advertising. There's liability in the state against mortgage brokers. And in fact, Your Honor may notice that the legislature over recent years has enacted several statutes in order to reform lending. One statute that they haven't repealed and haven't changed is the Credit Agreement Statute of Frauds, which simply requires that you get it in writing. Now, in order to promote certainty, the General Assembly enacted a statute which applies not only to that core agreement, that agreement to lend money, the agreement to repay the money and the terms securing that, but the legislature enacted a statute which also barred any claims based on representations relating to that. Now, the legislature did this in a clever way. What it did was it took the ordinary definition of a credit agreement, which would be that core agreement I talked about, the promise to lend, the promise to repay the money that was borrowed, and it expanded that definition beyond what colloquially may be considered a credit agreement. And it did that in subsection 1 of the agreement. In subparagraph 1, it says a credit agreement is a contract, promise, undertaking, offer, or commitment to lend, borrow, repay, or forbear money, repayment of money, or to otherwise extend and receive credit, or to make any other financial accommodation. I think that pretty much encompasses what the colloquial understanding and what counsel probably understands and has described as what a credit agreement is that someone borrows money, they promise to repay it. But this legislature went beyond that. In subsection 2 of that definition, it says any amendment of or cancellation of, waiver, or substitution for any or all of the terms of the provisions of any of the credit agreements defined in that subparagraph 1 and also subparagraph 3.
As definition. You said earlier, this was approved by the legislature with, as you said, the lobbying efforts of the Banking Association. And therefore, I'm assuming, although it's perfectly all right for the Bankers Association to lobby the legislature, that those broad terms are the result of what the Bankers Association wanted in order to protect itself, right? I mean, the agreements, the provisions that you're stating didn't arise out of thin air in the halls of the state legislature. They were clearly to protect the Bankers Association and its members, right?
Yes, I think that the...
And it's perfectly legal. I'm not saying there's anything the matter with that.
Well, it's not up to us to question how legislation and sausage is made.
Right.
I've heard it said before. So the General Assembly added any amendment, anything that would change pretty much that core agreement. But then it went further. And it said, any representations and warranties made, this is also a credit agreement, any representations and warranties made or omissions in connection with the negotiation, execution, administration, or performance of, or collection of sums due under any credit agreements defined in subparagraph 1 and 2 of this paragraph A. So any oral statement made by a member of the lending industry that you won't have to repay your loan, that we won't collect it, that it won't be for, that we won't forbear, that would come under this paragraph 3, and that itself is a credit agreement, which must be in writing and signed by the lender in order for that representation to be enforceable. Now, the nexus of the statute is subsection 2, where the legislature provided that no party may file or maintain any action relating to any of those three definitions of a credit agreement. That means no action may be brought based on an oral statement, based on representations and warranties, for the performance of, collection of sums due under a credit agreement, or the administration of that credit agreement. Now, here, the Hadleys attempt to present some gray area, but this is a fine line. It must be in writing and signed by the party against who's going to be enforced. And they fail to present any clear argument as to why the oral statements upon which they base their claims do not fall under any one of these definitions of a credit agreement. And they fail to present any clear argument as to why they don't at least relate to the administration of a credit agreement or the collection of sums due. Now, it's beyond dispute, going over the Hadley's claims, that the agreements for the two loans, $184,000 and $36,800, are in excess of $25,000. Therefore, the credit agreement statute of frauds applies. The representation on which the Hadleys based their claims, that Countrywide would not require them to make the monthly payment required by the notes, or that unpaid amounts would be added at the end of the loan term at an agreed rate of interest. These alleged representations also fall under the broad definition of credit agreement under subsection 1, 2, and 3 as defined in the statute. First, it's a promise to forbear on collection of sums due. That would implicate definition number 1. Second, it would have the effect of waiving Countrywide's right to collect the deficiency. That would come under section 2, which defines credit agreements as a waiver or a change to those core agreements. And third, because it's a representation made in collection with the negotiation, execution, administration, or performance or collection of sums due under the notes and deed of trust, it would also fall under 3. As found by Judge Hoffman, the essential character of all these promises on which the plaintiffs bring their claim is that the lender would forbear from foreclosing on the property and instead agree to something less than the full amount of arrearages to cure the deficiency. Borrowers argue at length that if this is indeed the law, it should be changed, but they don't cite to any authority on which this court can go in and change the statute. That's something that's left to, that should be left to the legislature. Borrowers attempt to argue that the deed of trust allowed for modification by oral representation, but there's no such language in the deed of trust. The language that they point to is titled Borrower Not Released, Forbearance by Lender, Not a Waiver. And that reads, extension of time for payment or modification or amortization of sums secured by this security instrument granted by lender to borrower or any successor of interest of borrower shall not operate to release the liability of borrower or any successes in interest of borrower. That section reads precisely the opposite of what the Hadleys argue here that it does. That section says that if Countrywide agrees not to collect right away, that it doesn't waive its right to collect those sums. Plaintiffs also argue that the district court made an improper judgment on the merits or evidence, but they don't cite any part of the record to support that, and no part of the order on dismissal really indicates that the court did that. It seems lost on plaintiffs that fatal to their claims is that they have said over and over that all of these oral representations related to the credit agreements. They said it in the complaint. They say it in page 9 of their brief. They say that all these oral promises relate to the note and the deed of trust. Now, plaintiffs also point to the credit reporting, but again, they ignore the third part of the definition that I cited to earlier. Any promise to fix credit agreement to say that the borrowers were not in default would clearly go to the administration or performance of a collection of sums due under the credit agreement. And that's all I have. The court has no further questions.
Your Honors, very briefly, I promise.
7 minutes, you can call if you'd like.
Your Honors asked, is it absolutely absolute immunity? And I submit to you that counsel did not address that question. This question raises the very issue that illustrates the situation here. Counsel pointed to the idea that there are regulations, that there are laws, that there are things absolutely restricting the formation of credit agreements, and absolute regulation of lenders who are engaging with borrowers to lend money, especially as here where it's a mortgage. That precisely illustrates the situation that once that credit agreement is in place, the bank, the way the statute is currently interpreted, and the way the trial court interpreted this statute, the bank can do anything it wants to its borrowers after the fact. There's nobody regulating their ability to pick up the phone and say, we have a soft landing program that we're going to enroll you in that doesn't affect your mortgage, that doesn't make us forbear, that doesn't make you not liable to repay your mortgage. It doesn't reach the situation where you pick up the phone and call the bank and say, what are you doing with my credit? You reported all of this stuff. And the bank says, you're right, we messed up and we'll fix it. And then they turn around and say, oh, it's not in writing under our credit agreement. It absolutely illustrates the point that this statute, as interpreted by the trial court, has gone too far. There is a bright line there. If it relates to the credit agreement, as counsel ably described the contents and issues of a credit agreement, then perhaps that's correct. When you get into separate agreements, separate workouts that don't ever, and the Hadleys never here, sought the bank to take less. They never sought the bank to change their underlying obligations. They never asserted that the bank wasn't going to get repaid. All that fundamental stuff that was described there didn't relate to the situation where Judge Hoffman reached, where he said all of this relates to the credit agreement.
Could you respond to Mr. Coakley's comment that in your complaint you purported to say that these related to the note and the deed of trust?
Your Honor, I think that there is an alternative. I think there's a pleading in the alternative there. I think that it's both, and perhaps looking back on it, perhaps not as artful as I would have liked, but I do believe that there's a situation where the credit agreement does, the two deeds of trust and the two mortgages do encompass the ability to modify them. But I don't think that that also incorporates any other situations, agreements, or discussions you have with your bank. And I do believe there's a bright line. I do believe those two things are distinct. Perhaps not as artfully described, but I do believe they're two distinct situations.
Can I ask you about the short sale agreement that you mentioned? And part of that short sale agreement, you allege that the bank agreed, among other things, that they would finance a fixed 30-year loan on the purchase of a new home. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do. Yes, Your Honor. I just looked at the record.
There's nothing in the record right now, but can you tell me if that new loan was in excess of $25,000?
Your Honor, it would have been. Bank of, I'm sorry, Countrywide never processed it, although...
But it would have been for...
To my understanding, they did agree to the short sale. They haven't sought a deficiency, though. That's not anything that we have alleged we were entitled to in this particular case. It would have been, but it never did exist. I have nothing further, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. That concludes this afternoon's arguments. The court will be in recess, and the bailiff shall so announce.